de-civilizing, we're undeveloping, and that as a society we've become far more individualistic, and our sense of community, which brings along to it a certain level of baseline trust, right, has fractured in so many places. And I think if you think about this kind of parallel track of what social media encourages, which is content, liking, numbers, scanning across this kind of, you know, like seeing a bunch of things and maybe noticing patterns, it doesn't really say, let's go deeper. It doesn't really say, let's get to know each other. The content is driving it, not the relationship. Relationships certainly can emerge, but you've got a software that really doesn't make it super easy, and you have lifestyles that almost resist it.
Online host, interaction designer, and facilitator Nancy White joins John and Scoop on this episode of the Plutopia Podcast. We explore online community, social media, macro versus micro connections, and much more.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Plutopia Podcast. Our guest today is Nancy White. Nancy's done international work supporting and practicing online face-to-face group facilitation for many years. She has focused on distributed work, strategic planning, social learning, communities like online communities and networks. She knows a lot about online community development and management, and a lot about social media stuff as well. So we're going to be talking about all that kind of stuff today, and probably complaining a lot about the downsides and how the internet is going to hell, I guess. What do you think, Nancy?
Well, are you just saying it's a geezer show?
It's kind of a geezer show, yeah. It's the old retired people complaining about the internet.
Well, you know, it's interesting you talk about, you know, what you have knowledge about. And I would say I used to have an extensive, deep, and practical knowledge of social media, and I don't anymore.
You don't, you're not active on TikTok?
No. No, and it's, you know, the things that we pay attention to definitely shift, right? And social media is one that I shifted quite far away from. And I know that when we have conversations about online community, it's a really important topic to see that intersection between social media and community, because I do not see them as absolutely overlapping. I see them as intersecting. But I know that you and I have some different takes on that. And I think that might be something really interesting to talk about, because I always like that, you know,
well,
what
I
we
just,
learn
I
from
think,
the differences.
I think it's hard to build actual community on a social media platform. I know it's possible, especially like Facebook. Facebook group could become a platform for a community to form, and I'm aware of that. But so much of what happens on Facebook is dry, and Twitter and Mastodon and all of those kinds of platforms is, it's kind of ephemeral, you know, and it's like drive-by posting. And because of that, your sense of having a strong community and having building history with people and that sort of thing is weaker, somewhat weaker, I think, in that context.
Well, you know, there's just been horrible news this past week about people coming up to someone else's house and being shot. And I think this is, and it's, I should go back and find the reference, because I saw it today. Someone linked to it. I think it was Priya Parker who might have linked to it today on her Instagram feed, which was, and she was quoting someone who says, we're de-civilizing. We're undeveloping. And that as a society, we've become far more individualistic. And our sense of community, which brings along to it a certain level of baseline trust, right, has fractured in so many places. And I think if you think about this kind of parallel track of what social media encourages, which is content, liking, numbers, scanning across this kind of, you know, like seeing a bunch of things and maybe noticing patterns, it doesn't really say, let's go deeper. It doesn't really say, let's get to know each other. The content is driving it, not the relationship. Relationships certainly can emerge, but you've got a software that really doesn't make it super easy, and you have lifestyles that almost resist it. You know, I want to be with my people. I want to be on my turf. I don't want to open myself up to trusting other people. And I mean, if you look at the types of legislation that are happening, they're about control and supporting one person's individualism over another person's individualism, but it's still about individualism. So I think there's a confluence here of both what's happening in society and what's happening with the things we use, our affordances, as Howard Rheingold used to say, make community the outlier, not the baseline.
Well, I think there's a tension between the way that technology can facilitate human connection versus the way technology can cause a kind of dehumanization, especially dehumanization of the other. And the problem seems to be that our sense of humanity or of the humanity of the other is challenged somewhat. I don't want to blame it all on technology, though, because I think there was some of that before we had the technologies we're talking about.
But technology makes it easier.
Yeah, absolutely. And more likely. And you know, before the mainstreaming of the internet, there was kind of a sense of community there because there were really few people and they were gathered in smaller clusters. But when you have when somebody posts something on Twitter or Reddit and there are 1,000 responses to it, you really don't have a sense of a conversation anymore. You just have people like, it's like they're throwing words at each other.
Yeah. And, you know, and the thing that things can go viral is both a positive and a negative. So, you know, I think for me, the question that I hold at this stage of my practice is where should we be focusing our attention in terms of building community? So you see people like, you know, I gave the example of Priya Parker or, Kat Velos. Kat Velos, who's here from Seattle, Ijeoma Olu, a number of people who are intentionally cultivating community by talking about community cultivation practices, right? Some people might call it facilitation, but I think it's far more expansive than facilitation. And also as I've gotten older, my concept of what facilitation is has changed. And they're being very intentional about how you invite people into an engagement. The scale of it is far more intimate. It's far more private because it's intimate. It doesn't, you know, it can't be an open door for everyone for most of the time. That's not saying there's not a place for those things, right? It's interesting to read these writers and see what they're thinking about. And it's a highly relational set of practices. These particular people are also highly inclusive of difference. So they make a space for us to come in and use our differences like with creative abrasion instead of things that we batter each other. And I even see it in the kind of face-to-face stuff in the two communities that I live in. And particularly coming out of post-COVID, I had my 65th birthday party Saturday in a little town of LeConnor, Washington.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you. And happy birthday you. You're just a few days before me or a few days after me. You're this week.
A few days after. Yeah, tomorrow, right. In fact.
Yeah. Well, happy birthday. And
thank you.
We all gathered for a, of all things, a geezer disco at a tiny gallery called Gallery W in LeConnor, who the two owners are just really welcoming and said, yeah, you can have a party here. He even brought a disco ball for us and a sound system. And we had local food and people who didn't know each other. Everyone knew me, but everybody didn't know everybody. They could talk to each other and connect and they realized, wow, COVID made all of our connections go online. And a lot of these people also happen to be around my age. So they're in transition from how they work. Like me, I'm only working part-time. Some of them are retired. we can be more intentional and choose how we want to engage in community with each other. But they really appreciated an invitation that was not just Nancy White's birthday, but it was Laconner and the Swinomish tribal community focused. It wasn't the universe of this or that, the other thing. So I think this idea of smaller, intimate connections can be really powerful. And then the interesting thing on top of that is, how do those network into a movement? How do those network into something larger? And I do think this is something that software can be helpful with, but that we begin to think about scale from micro to macro and weave our sense of community and broader network, understanding those patterns.
Well, that's an interesting point, that the idea that you, rather than trying to build like a big room, you build clusters of people, and the way you scale is through networking those clusters versus trying to get everybody into the same room. It's sort of like that, the thing where they would broadcast a conversation in some of the, I think it was Hotwired was doing this early on. Mm-hmm. They'd have somebody who would come in and would talk, and they wanted people to have the sense of being in the talk. And what they did was they had rows with seats, basically, mm-hmm. virtually. In other words, they would create a bunch of little rooms that all were receiving mm-hmm. the primary conversation that was going on, but they could also chat with each other yeah. as it was going on.
It's, you know, like we do the Zoom breakout rooms. But I think the other really strategic question is, when do you move things towards the macro and when do you keep it at the micro? That's one dimension. That slider this way. And the other slider is size, right? So it's not just, frequency. I don't know. There's something about size and frequency, because if we take every micro experience and expect it to map onto a macro one, it's all going to fall apart again. And we'll go back to likes, because likes are easier. They're manageable. We can squeeze them in. So whatever it is, this tension between micro and macro and how often it is and what the size of the macro is, has to be, you know, more of the micro and less of the macro, but the macro has to have a real clear intention. So, you know, look at the well. The well is full of micros because it's conference based, right?
Yeah.
I'm interested in this topic. I'm interested in this cluster of topics. I'm interested in this person, so I'll go to their cluster of topics because they're interesting. I'm interested in avoiding this person, so I don't go to that cluster. But rarely, well, I can't think of if ever, there is a macro all the way across it. And I wonder, when we think about the, you know, the growth of a community, is how often does it there have to be the macro in order to still feel like I'm a sense of this larger thing? It's not just about my individual things. And the WAPs, the face-to-face things, don't really do that because they prioritize a certain geography.
Well, and they pull a certain set of people together who are in proximity. Yeah, sorry, Scoop. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, on Facebook, you see their communities, attempts at being a micro environment. But because of the scale of what Facebook is, that is not as micro as a lot of people would want it to be. But the whole thing that's driving this desire to have a big, huge environment with lots of things going on is seems to be driven essentially by a lot of politics, because in the early days of the internet, it wasn't so much like, I mean, you saw the occasional flame war, but these days it's a constant flame war between this political belief and that political belief, or this social group and that social group, and they're huge groups. So it's kind of hard to get micro on the thing, on anything like Facebook or any of the social media outlets.
Yeah, yeah. And again, that's that interesting parallel between what the software facilitates and what's happening in society and our polarization and craziness. And I put that on all sides. I don't paint that as a them versus us thing. Makes it really difficult. So, you know, what would be like, imagine there was three questions you could ask yourself. And this is coming out the top of my head, so I do not have a plan here. This is in the moment that I could ask myself is, you know, what I want to engage with, whom and how, right? And so I'll give you a Facebook example. I don't like Facebook, but I'm a helper in my local Buy Nothing group. And I really love what has happened over time with our Buy Nothing group. It has embraced changes in our socioeconomic structure of our geography. It's allowed a lot of things and a lot of learning to happen between pandemic, Black Lives Matter, and the increased urbanization of our particular neighborhood. I really love my local LaConner Facebook because that's how I know what's happening. I don't engage personally a lot in those, but I do feel very much in community with them because I'm there because I care about that community itself and the geographic community. The rest of it's all ads. I swear the rest of it is all ads or people wishing each other happy birthday, which, you know, is nice, but would I prefer to have those interactions in things that's outside of that container? Yes. And would I prefer that I spent more time cultivating relationships within those? Fully on me. Yeah. So I don't know what your three things would be.
Well, I mean, if I was to suggest that there has been a sort of process of dehumanization going on, or that people are kind of starting to relate to other people as though they're not quite people, but they're just kind of like objects in a media environment, kind of, or whatever, and that's driving some of the escalating tensions, that you don't see the other as a human being. You see them as a representation in text and images on a screen somewhere. So if we posit that that's going on and that we're starting to have polarization partly because of that, and that it's having this problematic impact, how do we address that? I mean, what would be a good way, where would our push be to try to push people in the direction of seeing each other as human beings again, you know, and being really clear that, you know, when somebody posts something and you want to post something really nasty to them, to think first, well, that is actually another human being just like me, you know? You know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about. Remember way back when, years ago at South by Southwest, we did that us/them panel. Bill Anderson was there. You were there. I forget who else was there. I think when we have fewer groups to focus on, it's much easier to cultivate those practices. When we have light engagement across many, it's like it's not worth the time. You know, it's like I just walk away or I say something nasty. It's like there's some level of skin in the game. There's some level of really saying, yes, this is important to me. Then those practices are actually, you can describe them. Well, we're working on I'm working on a project that has a global collaboration, and we're jokingly calling it the framework of grace. But Redsley, what is the container we hold? And it contains three or four principles and examples of how we live them and counterexamples of what happens when we don't live them. So that, you know, we can say, and so interestingly, one of them is imposter syndrome, which I think is a very interesting dynamic of why we treat people poorly or well. People who have imposter syndrome can often be the first people to treat other people poorly.
I have imposter syndrome. I try not to treat people poorly, but I think I feel that sometimes.
But it's amazing how common that is. And when you don't know people, you don't know they're feeling that. So the other thing is you have to get to know a fewer number of people in at least one way more than just their username and what they post. We used to, long ago when we were doing online stuff, it was all text-based, you know, it's like once a year we could have a group telephone call, and that was exciting. And, you know, the principle was we need to have space to get to know something about each other on a regular basis to deepen that relationship. Because, and I blithely say, we're less likely to shoot someone that we've had a conversation with, or we've had a meal with. So tools that don't encourage drive-by, tools that make it a little more difficult to post and run, or to like or dislike and run, might be one way to do it. But I think there has to be a conversation about what we value.
So we, on the well, we have these linear conversations that go on and on. And it's, you kind of have in any particular, we call them conferences, like it's a major group of topics on the same subject is called a conference on the well. It's referred to as a conferencing system. And it's basically a bunch of people talk. Somebody will post something and asynchronously another person will come by sometime later and see what was posted last and respond to that and so forth. Just to make it clear for people who aren't familiar with the well or with that kind of system. But it was originally like a bulletin board system. So you have these conversations going on and they continue. They don't just roll over, you know, like on Facebook, you might post something and get a few responses to it and it just kind of
disappears.
Rolls off. Yeah, it goes away because your activity stream is constantly renewing, right? So on the well, people begin to have more of a sense of the other people as people. It's partly because of what I just said, that there's kind of a history building. And it's also partly because people see each other in different contexts. It's like you may see somebody posting something in the politics conference that really pisses you off. But then you might go to the parenting conference and hear that they're struggling with some issue with their kids. Somebody, I'm repeating what somebody said recently. That's not from me, but I get the point. You know, it's like when you see different sides of people or different dimensions of people, then you don't write them off as readily, yeah. Or you don't say, well, you can just go to hell. You know, you think, man, they're having a hard time, you know?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we did in a large, it was an industry collaboration, is we encouraged everyone we paired people up and had them interview each other before we did our online engagement. And we gave them, I think it was like 3 prompts that if they couldn't figure out what to ask, you know, I don't know what to say. But most people, like the minute they started the first prompt, they didn't need 2 and 3, right? They talked to each other. And when they came into the space, they were already engaged in a social agreement as well as a content interest, right? So it's like the old three-legged stool of communities of practice. You've got the domain, what we care about. So that would be the topic of a conference. We've got the community, that is the people that care about the domain. And then there's the practice, which is how we interact and learn and apply what we experience or learn or do in our worlds. And I'm not sure that it's a great framework when you're designing something, of what to pay attention to. And the rule of thumb, this came from Etienne Wenger, trainer, you know, he says, you should always be looking at community, domain, and practice, but don't mess with all 3 at once. So it's this interesting dance, right? Of, you know, what we care about, how we care about it. So, but are those values baked into how we design work or design play or design platforms? No, not really.
Well, the design of platforms on social media, it seems to have given people the feeling that they are invisible somehow. They can say these horrible things that they would never say to that person if they were standing in front of them in a room, or even if they were.
Now I think they would say it face to face.
Yeah. I've experienced that with people that I've known for many, many years, and they take offense to something I said and say really nasty things, and then I see them in person on the street, and they apologize. They said, I don't know why I did that. It just, I got used to doing that online in all these political things. A lot of these people are political people, and they were so accustomed to attacking anything that they disagreed with, that they would never do that in person, or many of them wouldn't.
Well, and attacking becoming something that people prize or brag about or value in themselves and in other people. You know, there's 3 generations in my household. And it's interesting to see how we talk about these things. And the youngest generation in my house, and that's an N of 2, right? A teen and a preteen, are very concerned about the way people treat each other in public and society. right? So, and I know that I think about my parents' generation, I'm at the tail end of the baby boomers. There was this thing called politeness, which wasn't about mamby-pambying people. It was about listening respectfully. It wasn't about you having to agree. But there's something that we lost. And, you know, back in the us-them days, John, we called it civility. And those things don't seem to be valued by many of our leaders who role model behavior that people then parrot back.
You know, more than once, I've had situations where there was somebody online that I knew strictly online, and there was tension, or they didn't like me, or maybe I was irritated with them or whatever. And at some point, we would have a face-to-face meeting. We'd both show up in the same place, and it would just completely turn around. Mm-hmm. And one thing I came to realize was that they were having a chance to see me smile and see me laugh. And I was having the same experience with them. I mean, we were seeing the whole person. Whereas before, we were sort of imagining who that person was based strictly on statements they were making in things they were posting online. And you know how that was. I mean, remember on the internet, no one knows you're a dog, right? Mm-hmm. Because nobody ever saw anybody. And then suddenly we had
avatars and pictures.
Avatars and images and so forth. And you got to see people more. But I can remember a time when it never failed to surprise me when I met somebody that I'd been talking to online. They never were the way I thought they would be, you know?
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I say never.
Sometimes they were, but
I often find that maybe it's, I wonder if there's a gender thing here. I often feel like if I've had, you know, enough ongoing interaction, my impressions were really good. Though I tell you, the funniest thing that ever happens to me, and I've met a lot of my online friends face to face over the years, is they look at me and they go, like, you're taller than I thought you'd be. Because we see this little, just a face, right? We don't see the body. Now with video, that may be changed, but
the thing I get is, well, you're not as much of a dick as I thought you would be. You're still a dick, but not that much of a dick.
Well, I mean, you're not as much of a Pollyanna as I thought you were.
Well, one thing that I've experienced is there's a lot of the younger generation are really communicating only by text mm-hmm. on the phone. And I've found that to be dangerous territory, because when you type out the text, you're not getting the whole person. You're not seeing their face, their expressions. And I've even gotten John upset because something I texted to him, I probably should have said it better. And it was totally, taken totally different from what I'd intended. But when you don't have the physical cues of seeing the person as they're saying that, it changes a lot.
Well, you can emulate those. I mean, some people can emulate, like with emoticons or with exclamation points or things like that. You can,
or how you write
often. Yeah, or how you write. But yeah, it's hard still.
But so I think for me, the text thing is everything is abbreviated, and I don't mean literally abbreviated, but you know, it's a short communication. And I used to be able to easily write two paragraphs to really convey an idea. I used to blog regularly. This all goes to writing. What I would call short form writing is now long form writing, right? Because now short form writing is, you know, seven words, and emoticons and abbreviations, literal abbreviations. And so do we convey nuance is one thing, but the other thing is, do we really convey any content of meaning? Do we dive deeper into something? And I think for me, I find I blog less, I write less, I scan more, right? I scan more, I scan Instagram, I scan this. I'm going like, I let that imbalance happen. And the software made it easy for me to let that imbalance happen. So I think this is something that's interesting about having more time in my life now that I'm only working part-time, is I can question that and I can choose and experiment with different things. So I'm reading more books. I'm playing my guitar. I'm having a birthday party. That's something I wouldn't have considered 5 years ago. It take too much work, right? I'm too busy. Too busy. And I think a culture of busyness also plays into this. So, you know, if I go on to the well, there's a couple places I always go, you know, some places because I'm a co-host, like with you, John. Other places because there's something I need, you know, to connect around or talk about immediately. But the vast of the other places that I, you know, joined or follow those conferences, I don't go in there because it takes too much time. And I lose that connection. And I lose those multiple perspectives on a single user, seeing them in politics and cooking, whatever, right? If I just stick to my own thing. So,
yeah, it's interesting how my experience of the well really changed a year or so ago when I became one of the co-hosts of Media, which is like one of the most active conferences on the well, and got sucked into, I mean, all kinds of stuff comes up there, and there's controversy, and there's, I find myself spending a lot of time in discussions where the hosts meet privately, you know, with other hosts about kind of what works in hosting and so forth. And I don't know, we've had what we refer to as thrashes about mm-hmm. particular people who were considered difficult in some conferences, but not in others. And what it is that you're just kind of, you're getting such a strong sense of all the people that you're dealing with, you know? Mm-hmm. And I never get that strong sense, like on Twitter, you know, on Twitter, there's just a bunch of stuff going by. And it could be, I often wonder whether my problem of with Twitter, which is that it just seems to be kind of all over the map, is mainly because I'm all over the map with my interests and I follow a bunch of different, you know, a bunch of different people and entities on there. And because of that, my feed is full of stuff that's kind of disconnected and discontinuous. I think there are actually people who use Twitter closer to the way we might use the well, where they get on there and they have kind of long conversations with each other and are back and forth a lot. And that, I'm not having that experience with Twitter.
Well, now you have to really know how to manage that tool to shape it to your needs. You have to know how to ignore huge amounts of advertising that gets pushed in between everything. But I know people who they have their lists and their group and they really, but they spend a lot of time making that happen. And I don't think the average person has that time and attention. But I want to circle back because, you know, we can bitch and moan. But if there were three things you'd ask before you either started or joined a community, what would they be? Scoop, I'm curious what you'd say.
That's what I would ask about joining the community. First thing is, is this a community of a particular interest? I mean, or is it all over the place?
Domain.
The all over the place things are, you know, not really something I would join. I belong to a lot of groups, but they relate to things that I do, things that I care about. The other general interest things I really don't care.
Mm-hmm. What's number two and three?
Number two is see number one. Number three is see number one.
So that's very interesting. So yours is very domain oriented, what it's about. Yes. Okay.
Which is interesting because, like, we've tried, I was kind of trying to form a Discord community for Plutopia, and I realized I came to get really clear how all over the map we are. You know, we're kind of unfocused. And I realized that if I was looking at a community as unfocused as we are, that I wouldn't quite know why I would join, you know, not that I would be hostile to it, but I just kind of like, what am I really going to get out of this? So I don't think we do a good job of answering Scoop's question.
Well, you actually, when I look at what we do, that actually is the kind of group, you know, my interests are all over the place. So, yeah, I would be attracted to something like what we do, who covers a lot of, you know, stuff that's not so much mainstream. It's more outliers of culture.
So there's a little framework or whatever you call it that I use with my clients when, you know, we're trying to figure out what the hell are we doing, right? What's on the table? And it goes something like this. And I'm going to put in community words here, but it's more flexible than that. The purpose of the Plutopia community is to do blank so that blank who can do blank, can do what? So the purpose of Plutopia is to bring together people to talk about emerging issues at the intersection between science, technology, and community, so that people who care about community have insights, tools, and diverse perspectives that they can go put to use in their communities.
Oh, that's great. I've been working on something like that, but it's really about like the purpose of Plutopia is to help humans be better humans with other humans. Whoa. That's what I'd really like for it to be.
Okay, so then you want to add this line to it. We know we are making progress when, and fill in that blank. Because when you have a purpose that is ginormous, I call it a mom and apple pie purpose, no one can disagree with it, but no one can find time for it on their attention span, right? So if you go to ginormous, you can narrow it by saying who this would be of value to, how it will be of value to them, and then we know it's of value when. We know it's of value when the communities we belong to are more joyous, productive, and inclusive, or that's even really big. We know we're making progress when we know when to say yes to engaging in a community and when to say no, because it just doesn't meet our standards or our ambitions or our gains. And I think, you know, I think this mom and apple pie problem is truly, it goes to what you said, Scoop, about what it's about, but how do I see myself in that about? How do I perceive that what I can contribute, what I can gain, how it will make a difference in my life? And a lot of times the imposter syndrome stops people right there. I don't have anything to contribute to that. I don't know anything about that. I may be interested in it, but then I become passive. I'm drive by, or I get defensive and attack. I mean, so people have to see themselves in the purpose of a community. And I don't think Facebook does a good job of helping us focus on purpose, but there are certainly groups who've done a brilliant job making it work despite the platform. Right?
When we started Plutopia News Network, that my approach was based on my history of working a long time in news as mm-hmm. a reporter, as a street reporter, as an editor. And so I looked at it more of what kind of publication would I want to create? And that is, you know, more news oriented. You don't just cover one subject. You have to, if you want to attract readership or viewers, you need to have a variety of interesting things. It needs to be interesting. If it's boring, I won't even go after it. But if it's something offbeat or interesting or just things we haven't encountered, that's my kind of story.
Well, and again, you're very content or domain centric. And does that need a discourse, right? It just needs the stream that you're curating and places for people to respond to that. But it may not suggest community. However, community may emerge because you may do a story on X and everybody's going like, wow. And then you spin off a discourse space to talk about that. Maybe it's a short-term thing. Maybe it's a long-term thing. But I think also when community became popular, John, you remember this. It's like everybody had to have an online community. You know, you saw Whole Foods.
And you
do
know
it.
That there was something interesting. Yeah, I mean, I did it at Whole Foods. Yeah. There's something interesting that Tex Coate once said, which was we were at some conference that Forum One was doing, and in the title there was something about creating community. And Tex said, well, I really question that. I don't think you can create community. I think you can create a platform for community, but the community is going to create itself, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do you build a platform so that it is friendly to the creation of a community? And then how are you going to feel about the people who come into it? If you have too many preconceived notions about who you think you want there, then that may be antithetical to actually letting the community form.
Well, this is what's interesting. I think business communities or consumer communities had a leg up because people want to know what other people think about a product, right? Some people love helping other people with a product. Some people like asking for help about a product. So there's a clear purpose. People know what they're there for. Is it a community? Some people will feel like it's a community. Most people will feel like it's a service.
Well, right? You know, when we built that community for Whole Foods, we had a bunch of things we were going to try. You know, I just kind of rolled out a bunch of different approaches to the conversation. And the two things that took off, one was something that Honoria Starbuck came up with, who was working with me, a food haiku. This is something that occurred to her. She lured a bunch of people over from the New York Times communities because they were interested in haiku, and she came up with this food haiku idea, and it really took off, right? The other thing that took off was a part of the community that we set up so that people didn't have to authenticate. They could just post there, and it was called Site Questions. And it was originally supposed to be questions about the website. If anybody has any questions about or complaints or whatever they want to talk about, we had all kinds of people coming in there. And a lot of it was not about the site. A lot of it was about the stores. We had things like, we had a guy who came in. You probably know him. He's on the Well, Barefoot, you know. He came in and was complaining about the fact that he couldn't go into his local Whole Foods store because they wouldn't let him come in without shoes on, you know? And I actually got him into a conversation with the manager of the store. I mean, we had a lot of interesting stuff going on, but none of it was what I thought was going to take off. The things I thought were going to take off weren't really the things that did. It was kind of like these incidental things that we did that were really popular. And part of the challenge was to back off on my own attachment to what I think should work and just follow what's really working.
The cow path thing.
Yeah.
Encourage it,
you know?
And so I think for me, this comes around to when people find a purpose in common, they can find affinity with each other and they can create community. That community can grow. It can peak. It can die. But it isn't the platform. The platform is an enabling piece of the process. And it isn't just local geography. It isn't just any one thing, but it's that sense of community, what we care about and how we care about it. So writing a haiku about food is a practice. We care about food. We care about poetry. And we care about, you know, I read your haiku, you read my haiku. And next time my haiku is going to be better because I learned something from you about your haiku. Or, boy, I actually can write haiku. I'm a haikuist, you know, these things. And again, I'll go back to Etienne Wenger Traynor and his work about social learning, which is identity is a huge part of how we interact as human beings. And content alone presents one aspect of identity, but likes, dislikes don't. And if we're consuming content and showing appreciation, that's great, but it's not about building identity, which leads to relationship, which is essential in community. So I think it's, you know, it's again, from a network, a community can spring, but you don't call it a community.
What do you call it?
A network. Random connections that can show patterns of density that can be attractors or strange attractors sometimes, that could become community, because community requires relationship and relationship requires knowing each other. As both of you said before, it requires identity, and identity cannot be perceived by content alone. It's built conversationally, iteratively over time. And a life is not a conversation.
It's kind of interesting. Yeah, this whole idea of building networks. Networks are ways that you can have weaker or looser relationships and they can still be meaningful, I guess.
Yeah.
And it made me think about, like, back in 1992, the Electronic Frontier Foundation had formed with the intention of being a community-based organization that had a bunch of chapters around the country. and various organizations were sort of forming, wanting to be chapters of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they brought a bunch of us all together at once. Ostensibly, I mean, the plan was we were going to talk about, we were going to all meet together and talk about how this, how the chapters part of the organization was going to work. But by the time we got there, they had decided not to do chapters. So what the conversation was then was not about how to do chapters, but how to build a network of these organizations where they would just be part of that network and they might be a prominent part of it and you know, kind of feeding into it a lot. But it would be a network. There would be a network of organizations that was a kind of entity that was kind of like the community they wanted to build, but the ties were going to be looser and there was not going to be a central organization driving it. They didn't want to centralize it. In fact, they said, we don't even believe that would be the right thing to do, to try to build this central organization and tell all the rest of you what to do. And I think part of that came from the fact that in an email list where we had conversations about setting this thing up prior to this meeting, they found out that people were had very strong feelings about what they wanted and that they didn't all agree, and that a lot of them didn't agree with what EFF would have wanted. So it was like, well, it doesn't make sense to take all of these people and shut them down and try to force them into the structure where we're at in the middle of it. So we went from being a community-based organization, or from the idea of that, to the idea of being a network. And it worked for a while. I don't think it's actually that network sort of went away for a while and recently reformed because they started putting some more effort into it.
I muted myself because there's now household sounds happening. There's a network that I was involved with here called Floodplains by Design, which was developed to first demonstrate the value of and then propagate the practice of good floodplain design that paid attention to the multiple needs of the ecosystem, including the human, but not only the human ecosystem, so that we reduce flooding and maintain healthy streams, particularly because fisheries are a really important part of our state and our treaty rights for the tribes in our state. And one of the tenets that was really important was we don't have to agree on everything, but we have to be together on the things we agree about. So this allowed people to advocate, to raise funds that are needed. There's a certain amount of synergy that has to happen to work in a complex system. I mean, you've got local government, county government, state government, tribal government. You've got people who want recreation, people who want fishing, people who are farmers and it's their livelihood, people whose homes are getting flooded. You've got all these different constituencies. You've got to find what's in common and shared. And you have to embrace and accept that you're not going to agree. You know, I don't see eye to eye with that farmer, but I'm still at the table with that farmer. And I think that was a very powerful strategy. And those programs, in fact, it was on the front, it was on our newspaper today about the Green River Project, how really successful it's been. But there was a lot of pain points along the way and some grieving and some loss because some things had to be torn down literally in order for something functional to arise.
Would you write this up and send it to the Democrats and the Republicans?
It has been written up. I think this is where I got really excited about networks and communities, because within that network, there's a community now of planners, because they all speak, you know, they're the engineers and they all speak their own language. And, you know, they don't really want to talk about all the social, this, that, and the other thing that crazy facilitator was bringing to the table. But they have become much more of a resource to each other and an informal resource that, frankly, can work around the hierarchy of their organizations or their bosses who have certain obligations upward that they don't have. They have their obligations downstream, literally. and when those, we have some things we call disappearing task force, when we needed to come together for something, we came together for a short time, but we didn't expect people to maintain that over time because the overhead of that is way too much. So I think there's also this sense of time is that a community is not, what's that word, you know, it lasts forever. Communities persistent. Come and go. Yeah, it's not necessarily persistent. And again, we can't belong to too many communities because we don't have the time and I think intellectual and emotional bandwidth to really participate in them. So we have to be strategic in which ones we pick. And it goes back to, well, can I see where I can add value and where I can get value? And I don't mean that in an extractive way. I mean that in a productive way. So that purpose thing, it keeps on coming back to that purpose thing. I'll stop there.
Well, I experienced a community, an attempt to build a community in the public radio space. I worked in listener-sponsored radio, Pacifica Radio in Berkeley and in Houston. And it was a great idea, but what really caused it to be very unproductive was so many people had their idea of what radio should be, and they were not willing to appreciate another program producer's idea of what radio or politics or whatever should be. I actually witnessed program producers taking microphone cables and fighting with them, whipping each other because they disagreed over the directions of the radio station. When that happened, that's when I just bowed out. Like, no, this is like you know, kids playing in a playground and not getting along. So that's one of the downfalls of some of these community building projects that go terribly wrong.
One of the things, so again, I think about strategies, you know, how could we avoid getting to that point? How can we surface our disagreements earlier and use them as a productive place of finding what's in common, what's not in common, what we want to compromise on, what we won't compromise on? And one of the things that showed up early on when I was working in international development work was in big international hierarchical organizations, innovation can come from any place, but the managers want it to appear that it came from them, right? So when an upstart down here has an idea, the tall poppy syndrome, you know, like cut off that poppy, they're sticking up too high. But if we took that idea and took it to someone who was in relationship with that boss, and this person says, you know, so-and-so is doing some really great work. I'm really proud of your team. Then that person would accept that person. So we had to triangulate away from the most direct relationship and create value through another connection in the network. And again, this is where networks are really valuable. Oh, the so-and-sos are doing that? Well, maybe we should consider doing that. Not because before we might have resisted because we didn't like it personally. I don't want you to do that kind of story. But oh, if such and such a radio just been doing those kind of stories and they just did an amazing fundraising drive, oh, maybe I should consider it differently. So triangulating, and that's hard in a very tightly knit community because there's so many interpersonal relationships. But in a network, you can influence by closing a new triangle, as it's said in network weaving lingo.
I think the downfall of the listener-sponsored radio efforts was that no one ever wanted to have a strong manager, someone who was actually going to take care, make sure the bills are being paid, make sure, you know, people are being hired for the few paid positions that were actually good people. And it was always, let's get the weakest person so we can pull stuff out that a strong manager would say, no, you can't be doing that. And they got in a lot of trouble many times because there was no one around to say, you should think about that before you say it or air it.
Yeah.
Now that's a governance question there. And I don't know, I've just been in a conversation about co-ops, and co-ops handle that really differently because it's shared leadership, right? You may have a person who's got a strong leader vibe, but they have to be more deferential than they would be if they were like the CEO of a private company where it's run like an autocracy. If you have a truly democratic organization, then number one, if you have somebody who's got some leadership skills, they can use those, but they have to be deferential. And the other thing is, you got to pass the baton some so that it's not always the same person who's taking the leadership role. You learn to pass that around. And I think communities, the whole sense of community could benefit from that kind of thinking and that kind of structure where you don't depend on one or two supposedly stronger people to decide things, and you learn how to decide it as a group, how to decide as a group what you're doing. You know, one reason democracy, well, if democracy is going to fail, one reason may be because we have such a strong commitment to autocracy in business. Mm-hmm. That's just a side thought.
But I think it relates to the community question too, because, you know, how much of the me am I willing to give up for the we? And that equation seems to have shifted significantly.
Well, and it's, you know, it's hard. Everybody kind of wants to have things the way they want them to be. I mean, we call ourselves Plutopia because for pluralist utopia, meaning kind of everybody gets their utopia, right? Figuring out
and
how
you
to
get
do
a
that.
Utopia, and you get a utopia, and you get a utopia.
But you to do that, you got to make concessions. You can't have everything. I mean, people say that all the time, but it's true. You just and all of your intentions and desires and what you will to be has to be moderated by all the other intentions and desires and will to be of other people. You know,
it reminds me of a quote I was graphically recording at a summit around community, and it was in someplace in Ohio, I can't remember where, and Peter Block was the keynote speaker, and I was graphically recording, and he comes up to the podium and looks at all of us, says, if this gathering were to be a failure, what would your role be in that failure? And I think asking that question, some people go, oh, that's a gutsy thing to ask people, like, how are you causing this to fail? But seriously, if we expect other people to create the thing we want or aspire to, so it isn't about acquisition, we're not going to get there. But if we're willing to take some responsibility and ownership to what is happening to ourselves and to other people, I think we have a chance.
And that's a social skill that people need to have, and not everybody has learned. And I think we're going through a period here where some people are kind of under the spell of a sense of a sort of delusional sense of strength. I'm thinking about the Trump phenomenon, you know, that I could be really strong and I can just demand what I want. And forget the laws, forget everything, you know, it's just what I want. And the problem is that if everybody is on that particular wavelength, then nobody gets what they want because everybody's kind of stepping on everybody else. And eventually everybody's just kind of undone.
Well, I would say also when we have that mindset, we're manipulable and much more vulnerable to being manipulated by people who understand the social dynamics and use them to their ends. So just like, what's the difference between a community and a cult?
Exactly. I mean, you can have people who are completely like sociopathic or psychopathic and understand people really well, mm-hmm. understand how to do that kind of manipulation. And we may have to go through that for a while before people sort of wake up. We were talking earlier today about the idea of like, you can be around a really charismatic person. Maybe it's somebody you're having a relationship with or whatever, and you kind of get under their spell. And at some point, when it works that way, the spell inevitably is broken. But there's a lot of difficult process getting to that point.
So let's think about what is the one... not positive, that sounds positive. One generative thing that we see going on around online community or community that we can leave each other with as we finish. What's the one thing you're most inspired about?
Well, from my side, I think that I'm seeing that more people are feeling distressed at the sense that we're kind of sacrificing some of our humanity and ready to take it back and looking for ways to relate to people that are not inauthentic, and that, kind of the kind of relationships that maybe work better in Mastodon than in Twitter, because Twitter is inherently set up to sort of be extractive, whereas Mastodon is set up to be more like a shared space. And I think we may see more developments like that.
Oop, how about you?
Pretty much what John said, really. And I really would like to have a nice community that is worth participating in. I've joined what I thought might be good communities, and it turns out to be some social media influencer who's trying to convince me to to do something that I really don't care about. So I would like to be able to avoid that. But, you know, having a meaningful sense of community is, you know, it's something I desire, but it's hard to find so far.
Well, I think
and I just wanted to honor the fact that you have limited time.
Okay, I'm really encouraged at the intersection of rediscovering local community with what the internet enables in terms of networks to amplify, to understand when to amplify something up and out that can do the kind of change, John, that you mentioned, because I agree very much with what you said.
Right on. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope you'll come back and we can talk about this some more.
Oh, you know, I don't have a problem talking.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.